You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to the Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss the episodes of TNG and a few tangents along the way. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
I'm James from London.
And with us again,
I'm calling from. I'm calling from Warwickshire in England.
Colin, how have you been, buddy?
Yeah, I've been good. Yeah, it's nice to get back on the mics with you two and geek out on Star Trek again.
Oh goodness!
Although we are, as James knows full well, we are suffering a heat wave at the moment.
Oh really?
Well, hang on a second. I mean, so this last week apparently it was supposed to be like on the west coast of America and into Canada, like 44 degrees Celsius. I think our heat wave's not quite there, right? What was today, like 26?
No, 29 where I am.
29? Still short of the 44 degrees. Let me have a check of what the temperature is.
Hang on,
I've actually been inside.
Yeah, the highest it hit today was 31.
Wait a second. So 29 Celsius to Fahrenheit is 84.2. So that's not incredibly terrible. But you said, what was a 41?
It's incredibly terrible for British
people. Oh, that's true. I see your point. So you guys can't handle an inch of snow and you can't handle a little bit of heat. Whoa. Oh, man, you should have been here last week. We had hurricane winds blow through our city. My power was out for 40 hours, as I told you guys. Some parts of the city were off for almost a week. Some parts of the area, as of 2-3 days ago, power lines were still down. Trees were still blocking roads. It was monstrous. I had no idea it was coming. It occurred about 1 a.m., and I was already asleep. All I know is my fan went out. I woke up, my fan blinked off, and I'm like, oh crap, how do I get back to sleep? So, 41 Celsius, 105 Fahrenheit. Now that is getting a little warm. Yeah. That's starting to feel it there, but good thing my car has air conditioning, and my house does too. So.
Yeah, my car doesn't have air conditioning.
And houses in the UK, they're not. I mean, I'm sure there are some with air conditioning, but it's exceptionally rare.
They're built to actually keep the warmth in. Actually works against it.
I guess it does. No central air there, huh? Wow. I'm a kid of the air conditioning era. I there's no way I could have lived in the 50s and 60s. It'd have killed me. But all right. So, we're here for... Oh, yeah. We're here for... Oh, did I even say that tonight's episode was Lower Decks? I think I left that out.
No, we haven't said that.
Yeah. I was trying to be sarcastic and smartassery, but I forgot to mention. Tonight's episode is Lower Decks. So, we are going to discuss that. Did you guys watch the show?
I've never seen Star Trek in my life.
Yeah. I'm just trying to extend the time while I get memory alpha, because I forgot. Okay, so here we go. And tonight, and the synopsis for tonight's episode is: junior officers speculate on the reasons for recent unusual actions taken by the command crew near the Cardassian border.
So, Lou, one second. Okay. You get this from Memory Alpha, do you?
Always.
Oh dear, Lou, you've broken the magic.
Oh, after 14 years of doing this show, you just realize that? Wow. I thought you knew. Okay. Well, sorry.
Yeah, well, there goes the fourth wall.
Exactly. Once in a while, I do make up my own little, you know, synopsis when I think it's funny. I can't come up with anything. But this is the 15th episode of Season 7, which means we're almost done. So only about another year to go of this podcast, guys. It was first aired on February 7th, 1994, written by Renee Echeverria, and story by John Wilkerson and Jean-Louise Mathias, and directed by Gabrielle Beaumont. Guest stars for this episode include Dan. I hate names. I should make James do names. I think you'd probably do them better. James Gather as Sam Lavelle. Shannon Phil as Cito Jaxa. Alexander Enberg as Tarek. Bruce Beattie as Ben. Patty Yasutake as Alyssa Agawa. And Don Riley as Dretal. So, what do we think of this episode? Colin? Oh, I'm sorry, James, you're ready to jump?
Oh, no, I just ask one thing. Ben, the Ben character. I haven't actually read around this. Was that supposed to be Guinan, and they just couldn't get Guinan?
No, it was supposed to be Ben.
Was it? It feels like a Guinan character. It's one thing like that bugs me throughout this episode, that it's almost as if it's clearly Guinan. But anyway,
no.
if it's originally written as an original character, then I take that back. But it just feels so Guinan to me.
No, I mean, I don't think Guinan would be playing poker.
Plus,
but she's played poker, right? Hasn't she?
She might have done in her 500 years of existence. Yeah, but
eventually, but. No, I think she's a little too high on the food chain with the command staff. I think the reason why they got this guy is he's kind of like one of the underlings of the ship. You got the underlings talking about the overlords, and he relates to both sides. I don't think Guinan would ever walk over to the underlings and just, you know, sit down and chit-chat with them.
I think you're being too harsh on Guinan.
Yeah, I might be.
Yeah, Guinan talks to anyone.
That's true. Well,
I mean, she's an Elorian, that a race of listeners.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That is true. So maybe they would, but.
But I think the purpose with Ben here is to link the upper echelons and the lower echelons.
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and Guinan wouldn't do that because everyone knows Guinan and Picard are best buds.
Yes.
So he wouldn't work in that context here.
All right. Did you?
Okay, sorry, I interrupted.
No.
Let's get back
no,
on,
that's,
back on track.
We were on track. So did you expect, or did you realize Ensign Cito was who Ensign Cito was?
So, okay, if that's a question aimed at me, I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure I watched this episode before I watched The First Duty.
Okay.
So I think I've mentioned before kind of like how I fell in to Next Gen. So I remember seeing some very early Next Gen when I was a kid. Now, we happened to have Sky TV, which is where a lot of it was being premiered, or at least it was being run frequently. I think it was run daily. So I caught a couple of episodes here and there on like the first two seasons. But then when I got back into it, what I ended up doing, so I ended up getting the videos that were being released here. And I remember that the episodes that were being released at the shops was the beginning of Season 7. So I ended up watching the entirety of Season 7 on video without having access to be able to watch the backlogs on TV, other than, you know, happen to find them or, you know, buy the video as it also had originally came out. And I didn't have the money to buy the videos, like, you know, retrospectively. I think I started to try to also bring in from Season 1 onwards, but I was basically watching Season 7 as it landed, and had huge gaps in my previous watching. So I don't think I knew who this character was at the time.
Okay. How about you, Colin?
Yeah, I don't know who she was.
Okay. Actually, I didn't get it at first. I didn't get it until she got her dressing
done. Like a new haircut or something?
Don't know. I just... I don't know. Maybe I just don't remember the faces of the one-off characters and say, oh.
It's a two-off.
Yeah, but I mean, the episode she was in was such a major episode.
It was. It just didn't hit me until she was getting dressed down by Picard about the cover-up.
So when you've seen Tom Paris in Voyager then, did you put him and the other guy together?
I didn't.
I don't remember, but okay. I don't think I would have. I mean, that was also, two series before.
Yeah, but he was supposed to be the same character in Voyager, and that's why he was imprisoned to start Voyager.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard all about that.
For royalty reasons. Yeah, for royalty reasons, they had to change the name.
Yeah.
I mean, that story always bugs me, right? Because when they talk about royalty reasons, how much would it realistically have cost for the writer of The First Duty to basically sign away that? I mean, it couldn't have cost much, right?
Yeah, but you think of syndication, James. Star Trek goes into syndication, which is what Star Trek did back then. It goes into syndication. And the Star Trek episode on somewhere on the planet all the time. So you think of the royalties from being constantly broadcast since the 90s till now.
But I would have imagined they could have just bought the writer out. I could imagine they could have said to the writer, look, we'll take your character. We've got it from now on. You know, here's $100,000. Mm. Thanks. I mean, surely they could have reached an agreement like that. Because there have been because otherwise what you end up with is you end up with something that really doesn't allow you to have recurring characters, right? So it means that when Seven of Nine was introduced, it would have to have been written by, you know, by basically the executive producers or the, you know, or the people in the show, rather than anyone else. And the same would have been said about any of the kind of like auxiliary characters that can't come in.
You've got precedents with the City on the Edge of Forever and the Guardian. You know, they wanted to reuse the Guardian, but
they did reuse him.
Yeah, he wouldn't let him. So it wasn't until Discovery that they reused the Guardian.
I assume the guy is now dead. I don't want to upset anyone. I don't know. I find it odd that, for all intents and purposes, right, it's the same character, the Tom Paris one. The Tom Paris one in particular, it's exactly the same character, the same guy, the same, you know, same uniform, the same haircut, the same backstory, and I would have just liked them. Surely they could have just sorted this out.
Well, do you think, is it, I think, if I remember, TNG used to let anybody submit a script.
Mm-hmm.
So, now, I'm looking at The First Duty, written by Ronald D. Moore and Naren Shankar, directed by Paul Lynch. Well, those are staff writers and a staff director.
Yeah.
So why would it have been a royalty issue unless the original premise came from somebody?
But I suppose Ron D. Moore wasn't on Voyager, and then Shankar, I suppose, is more on the edges. But, yeah, I mean, this must have been by a story by then, surely.
Yeah, well, it says written by the two and then directed by Paul Lynch, but I don't know if there was a spec writer, you know, somebody who just sent it in, whether it would even be listed written by them, but that's what I had heard too, is that whoever wrote that episode, every time they use Nicholas Locarno in Voyager, he gets a check. And of course, obviously, 27 or 7 seasons of each 20 some episodes, that would have been a lot of money, more than $100,000, I would assume, especially with all syndications. But I don't see anything in Memory Alpha that says it was written by somebody like that, so. What do I know?
I think these things are—you can work these things out. Yeah. I think you can always work these things out, and it always just feels like it's petty when they don't. And I'm going to bring up something else, which is the what you leave behind in Voyager, right? So, I mean, I don't want to really spoil this for anyone, but Terry Farrell isn't in the cut in the look back sequences in What You Leave Behind. So, you know, as people are going through and, you know, remembering all the good times that they've had over the previous seasons, no one, whether it's Sisko or Worf, who was married to her, have any recollection of Terry Farrell's, you know, Dax, which is just horrendous. Now, I understand that she wasn't on the show at that point, but they surely could have reached an agreement whereby they gave her money to use her likeness and to have her nominally appear on that one show. And I appreciate that, looking, they probably got into an argument about how much it's worth. But it, again, that's something that, you know, it bugs me, right? That we're still watching this 35 years later, and some kind of petty argument about money kind of shapes what we're watching.
Well, I think you can thank Crispin Glover for that. He's the one who played McFly, Marty McFly's dad in Back to the Future. They used his likeness in the second movie that he didn't want anything to do with, and he sued him for that. And now there's Screen Actor Guild laws about that they can't use anybody's likeness after they're off the project. So probably that's...
I mean, no. So I don't have a problem with them not being able to without permission. I'm just, you know, I just think that if you're on a show for 6 years, right, which Terry Farrell was, and you've obviously worked with these people and you're integral to the show, it's unfortunate that either her or the producers or whoever couldn't just get an agreement, reach an agreement as to you know, as to how to make it work. You know, they reached an agreement with everyone in the original series, right, for Trials and Tribulations, to how that would work. But we couldn't get Terry Farrell in a couple of scenes at the end of Voyager. It seems...
But I get you. I get you.
Yeah. Let's carry on. And by the way, Deep Space Nine is on my mind because I've been watching a lot of Deep Space Nine. As I mentioned before we started the call, I have recently been ill, and I have recently managed to get through like 25 episodes of DS9 in a weekend.
Yep. He had COVID, y'all, so if you start feeling coughs or body aches or start losing taste and smell, it's because of James, I'm afraid.
Actually, the loss of smell is the weirdest one. It really is. And I started, I started In the Cards on DS9, and I went, I'll try to figure out how far I went, but it was like well into the next season, well over halfway through. Anyway, carry on, everyone, carry on.
All right.
As you were.
So as we begin, we're in 10-4 with Riker and Troy discussing crew evaluations and promotions. And sitting over there on the other table is the group who are always together that are discussing career evaluations and promotions. Which one of them is going to get promoted? Well, if they're Harry Kim, none of them. But, so we have an engineer, the Vulcan. We have Alyssa Ogawa. Is this her first time on the show? I didn't think it does. No, it wasn't. No.
No, she's been around forever.
So it's interesting. Then we have Sito as the con officer. And then we have Sam, who I'm not exactly sure if he's an ensign or what. And, oh, she was security, wasn't she? Yeah, she was security. And they're all... It seemed to me that there was only one promotion available. Was that right?
So there wasn't only one available because two get promoted by the end of the episode. Yeah. But the thing that was opening, right, was the, you know, the gamma shift's con position or ops position, whatever it was that they thought was worth fighting for.
Yes.
So I think that both Sito and the other guy,
Sam.
They were going for what? They were both going for. For ops. That's really the thing, and that came with a promotion,
right?
But I imagine, by the way, this is much more that it's like it's a position on the bridge, close to Picard, dangerously close to the exploding chair as well, unfortunately, for their longevity, and the panel that they sit behind. But I think, you know, they're going for it to get to be close to command, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. So they're dying to be promotion. There. Alyssa gets promoted. The one thing about Alyssa that I was having problems with is every time, Alyssa, yes, doctor. Yeah, I want to talk to you about the promotion. Oh, it'd be great, doctor. Well, I think you deserve it. Oh, thank you, doctor. Thank you. It just seemed a little over the top. Right? Wrong?
I think wrong. She was a shoo-in, basically.
Yeah.
So I mean, she's been on, like what we said, she's been on the show for a while, and the doctor's her boss, and we don't actually see a lot of people in Medday as it is, so it's not like she had a lot of conversation.
No,
because every time someone is Medday, it's I mean, you know, you think with a crew of 1,000 people there'd be more than one doctor for starters.
There is,
but we don't see a lot of the other doctors, and we don't see a lot of the other nurses.
No.
So I think she was kind of a shoo-in from the get-go. So it wasn't really a surprise that she got promoted. But she did seem a bit overly contrived, shall we say.
Yeah.
So what I like about this episode in particular is... So this episode is really... It really leans into the idea of being able to project Star Trek onto, like, the real world, right? So you're seeing... You know, you're not seeing the superhero action at the top. You're seeing the ordinary folk at the bottom. And in particular with, like, things like crew evaluation. And I should probably mention that I'm about to do my work. I'm about to head into my mid-year review session. So this is somewhat timely. I have to say, I think that this is great seeing how everyone is behaving. And also, I think this shows you that really only Crusher is a good manager. Everyone else is horrendous, whether it's Worf or whether it's Geordi or whether it's I don't know if technically Lavelle reports into Riker or not, but you know, everyone other than Ogawa, they seem to have no support, and they seem to be really you know, why I wouldn't want to hang around if I was any of the other three, right? They're not getting a lot of
Forge's management skills have been dire from the get-go.
Yeah, absolutely.
He has literally no management skills. He doesn't know how to talk to people. He barks at people. He dismisses people. If someone comes to him with anything, he's like, he's condescending. He's patronizing. He's not a good manager.
And he actually recognizes that in this episode, right? He even gets to the point where he feels sorry about how he's treating his engineer. It's like, hey, please, you know, if you have any other suggestions, you know, please feel free to bring them to me. Okay, I have these. Go away. Go away. I don't want to listen. He's dreadful.
The other flip side of that is Geordi's running engineering. He's running the heart of the ship, you know, as the pack leads say, what makes it go. And this little engineer is focusing on little things, whereas Geordi's focusing on the big picture.
Okay, then Geordi needs to have a command structure underneath him, right? He has to have, you know, because it is fair to say, look, on a ship of 1,000 or however many there are, there's got to be a good, you know, at least 50 engineers, right, in main engineering.
Yeah, you've also got to have someone who's in charge of engineering while Geordi sleeps.
So he's going to have a command structure behind him in order to support that, and you just never see that. So look, you know, the truth of the matter is that if, you know, if you're a commander and you have a junior ensign turn up, then you probably do want to keep him a couple of rungs below you in terms of management. So it's probably unfair for Geordi to be the guy managing this particular Vulcan. And I know that Vulcan,
he has got form for these, though.
He does. He does.
Yeah, I mean, when Scotty was on the episode, he was really horrible to Scotty.
Yeah, I remember. I hated that.
But also, I have bad things to say about Worf as well, because, you know, Worf, on the surface, he's kind of supportive, right? So he's like, oh, I'm going to, know, this particular ensign of mine's doing a very good job. I want to support her. I want to put her forward. But he ends up killing her. So that's no good either.
Yeah, I mean, he's a Klingon. And to join in the line of duty, he's to a Klingon's major.
Well, this thing, so at this point, my incentives and my manager's incentives from this ensign's perspective, they might not be aligned, right? If your manager's incentive is that, hey, as long as you die in the line of duty, it's all A-OK, I might want to change manager.
Don't you also think that her situation is because she doesn't actually get ordered to do it, she actually volunteers to do it, but she's they kind of maneuver in a direction where she's going to volunteer, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But the other edge of that is she wants to prove that what happened at Starfleet Academy isn't her.
Yeah, so the thing about her volunteering is that she has almost zero power in the situation she finds herself in, right? So she's been dressed down by Picard. Picard makes it clear to her that she's the worthless piece of scum that he found on the bottom of his shoe. The only person that'll stand behind her is Worf, who's kind of like a crazy psychopath that's hell-bent to go on any suicide mission he can find. It doesn't leave her a lot of room, right, in terms of career progression, if she doesn't volunteer for this kind of thing. And I would suggest recklessly. So I hope the Enterprise has a good HR department when her parents try to sue them.
Yeah, but don't forget Picard dressing her down was to see how she would react.
Yes.
Because knowing what she's going to do, and knowing that Picard was a prisoner of the Cardassians, he's testing her mettle.
I accept that. It's just that I wouldn't be able to get away with it from an HR perspective.
not in the politically correct woke environment we live in at the moment. No, but I mean, you know, this is deep space, and basically Picard is the master of all his surveys. So.
Okay.
Actually, I have it down here that it's the ops night duty officer, and is that really worth going for in terms of a promotion?
It's to get on the bridge, though. I mean, it's like getting to head officer at a big company.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. I would. The question is it would you rather be like, you know, third in line on the main shift or first in line on the night shift?
You've got to remember
the night shift. Beverly sort of sometimes does the night shift because we've seen her do it, or Data does the night shift because he doesn't need sleep. Now Data is effectively third in command. So if the person who's third in command notices you, and Data's also head of operations, you know, that just, it's the night shift doesn't mean that you're not going to get noticed.
Well, actually, I think you've probably hit the nail on the head here, which is that if you do work the night shift, you're probably perpetually working for Data for the rest of your life.
Oh, boy. But here's the thing also, you know, it depends. At our age, no, I really don't want to go back to the night shift thinking that I might get something in the day shift or they'll notice me for a better job on the day shift. I don't have that long to live. But at their age, sure.
So is the Enterprise on a three shift or a four shift rotation?
They run a four shift.
Okay, because I know that Jellicoe kind of changed it.
Oh, I don't think so.
Jellicoe changed it to a three shift system. Okay. But they run
if they're on a four shift, then I can accept the four shift. I think night shift on a three shift location. On rotation, that's tough. Like doing 8 hours.
Yeah, but you also got to remember, night shift on a Federation starship is relevant because they use Earth time as their marker. If you go to another planet, it doesn't mean that your night is their night.
True. And in fact, the entire thing, right, is that what the hell is the difference between a day and night shift when you're actually on a spaceship? It makes no sense.
It's a 24-hour thing anyway, so...
Right. And if I was head of Starfleet or head of Starfleet security, the first thing I would do is that I would desynchronize all of the night shifts across all of the ships, because you pretty much know that if the Vulcans, or sorry, if the Romulans are going to attack, they'll probably do it during the night shift. There's no reason... You know, no reason to give an enemy a tactical advantage. Every every ship should be on a different, like, randomized shift setup to avoid any kind of...
It would be interesting to see what navies do in regards to shift patterns. I mean, I don't know if we've got any listeners that have served in the Navy, but if you have, drop a line and tell us what the Navy does. And is this based on the Navy? Does the Navy have a three or a four shift system? That would be interesting to know.
Well, I do remember that Jellicoe wanted a four-shift shift system when Riker says it would be extremely difficult to do. Well, I don't care. Get it done. What happened after Jellicoe was gone? Riker probably said, Captain, could we go back to that third shift, that three shifts that we like so well? Make it so, number one. Done!
So you'd have Alpha, Beta,
and Gamma.
So...
Yeah.
That's capricious. So yeah, so as soon as Jellicoe, the door closed on the airlock.
Yeah.
That was gone.
So do you think, let's say, you know, obviously our bodies are on a circadian rhythm and we have an internal clock. We know what time we go to bed. It's fascinating the fact that, you know, it's 6 hours ahead. I look outside on my cameras and I see the bright sun. What do you guys see over there right now?
The sun's about to set.
Yeah, and we still got another 6-7 hours before our sun sets. So, it is curious what happens to our circadian rhythm if I go live over there. How long would it take for me to adjust to the time frame?
2 weeks.
2 weeks?
I was about to say a couple of days, but...
All
right. The average person adjusts to a climate and time zone in 2 weeks.
It surely is also easier to go east to west than to go west to east, right?
Yeah, when I've been to America, I'm less tired coming back into my own time zone than I am going the other way.
Okay, so...
Because your body's used to that time zone.
So, James, when you were here for Las Vegas, Star Trek Las Vegas, and it ended, what, 4 o'clock in the afternoon? It was actually 10 at night. I mean, were you like, I'm so tired, I gotta go to bed.
So I find going to the States is easier, because what you're being asked to do is you're being asked to extend your day. So what you effectively just have is that you have a little bit of a nap in the middle of the day as you're flying, and then you have like a bit of an all-nighter, and then you go to sleep, and then you can like more or less shift into the local time zone. And I find that easier than coming back the other way, because instead of having an extended day whereby you're basically being asked to stay up like 24 hours straight, you're having a compressed day where you're being asked to take a 24-hour period and squish it into like, you know, 12 hours. Okay. And I find that hard.
Losing time, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the reason why I bring that up is not so much a tangent. I want to roll it into this episode. No, I'm very serious. I want to roll it into this episode now. Is this because we can see daylight, whereas when you're on a ship in space, you're never seeing daylight except when you pass a bright star? How do you think these guys adjust to the Alpha, Beta, Gamma?
When you think of the episode where Data says begin night watch, they dim the lights. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's night watch. It's always night. So it has to be just the clock.
When he says it, they actually dim the lights. Okay. So that's probably like, you know, I don't know, obviously that was just a bridge, but if they did that on, you know, the whole ship, then I suppose that's a little clue. But you've also got to think that this is a Federation starship. So, you know, there's going to be species on there whose sleep patterns aren't human sleep patterns. Like Vulcans don't sleep like humans. No. They meditate.
No.
You know, if you go to Enterprise, I think Phlox slept once every 6 days or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but Phlox didn't sleep much either.
Right.
You know, yeah, that was it, a hibernation cycle? That was it. He had a hibernation cycle, yeah.
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 So, you know, you're talking 1,000 people. Not everyone's going to be human, not everyone's going to work on the 24-hour clock, not everyone's going to have the same sleep cycles, so, you know, it's a bit of a misnomer when you look at it like that. And like James said, you know, you're in space, it's dark all the time.
So how do they adjust? It would be curious how they adjust. Now, I mean, on the International Space Station, they see the sun, or they could see the sun 24 hours a day, I suppose. So...
Yeah, it says the... the International Space Station like orbits the Earth many times a day. So they have I don't know what it is, but it's like then they have like 5 sunrises every single day as that's spinning around.
No, I think it's more than that. I think it's like 16.
Okay, but it's not as if they're they're not geostationary. They're not staying in a position.
But they use the time zone of Houston, don't they? That's their time zone.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I always wondered, you know, how do they know? How does their body know it's time to go to bed? And then you add Deep Space Nine in the mix, where they add 2 more hours onto the day.
Yeah, but there's also, like, on about time zones and all, there's an episode in DS9 where Sisko goes to see the presidents in Paris. And he beams from one country to the other, and the one country, it's daylight, and when he beams to Paris, it's dark.
Right. Okay. All right, well then, so we're going to make a run for the Cardassian border. Well, not really, but we are going to go towards the Cardassian border. So the overlords are discussing what's going on. One thing I liked about this episode is while the overlords were all discussing things that was happening, all the underlings are also together discussing what are we doing? I don't know. Nobody's going to talk about it. It was kind of interesting to see both sides of the coin. We don't normally see that.
No. And I don't know if you're... James, are you familiar with Upstairs Downstairs? The TV show?
No, not the TV show.
Okay. It was a TV show that basically it was the workers in a posh house. I think it's Victorian times. And that's one of the inspirations beyond this episode, because you've got basically the underlings. And it's they very rarely mix with the upper echelons, because there's no reason to, unless you're on the bridge. And that was one of the inspirations behind it. Now, when you look at them in 10 Forward, they sit in their little clique, and the senior staff sit in their little clique, and they don't mix.
Hmm.
And that's this episode gives us a chance to see it from the other side of the coin, so to speak, and that's why a lot of people really like this episode.
Yeah. I honestly didn't quite remember it all that well, but from what I did, I didn't think I was going to like it until I actually watched it and made my notes for it. And it is a good episode, actually, which I just realized we didn't get our initial thoughts in, but what are you going to do? One tangent, it's all done.
It's also like some of the it's like you say, like the guy who's always in the background in 10 Forward, the waiter that you keep seeing.
Yeah.
You know, Ben. He's the waiter in the background in 10 Forward.
Yep, the little guys.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, we already discussed about the Vulcan, which I actually thought reminded me a lot of Vorok in Voyager. His voice sounded the same. His facial structure looked almost the same.
It's the same actor.
It is the same actor.
Yeah, it's the same actor. Good. And they got around it by saying that they're twins.
Didn't want to pay royalties.
There you go. Yes.
Yeah. But Jerry Ryan says that they're twins.
Ah.
And isn't that Bajoran Seska? I'm pretty sure she is.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
No. Well, the Cardassians are enough to pay royalties.
All right.
But no, it's not Seska, no.
No, I know.
The actress who plays Seska does pop up in Deep Space Nine as a Romulan.
Yeah. Yeah, looking after the floating device.
What was the point of that? We'll talk about that another day. Having a Romulan actually there for the cloaking device for, 3 or 4 episodes, and all of a sudden she was gone. We'll do it ourselves. Thank you very much. Goodbye. Yeah, we'll talk about that another day. Okay, so engineering a Vulcan is a Vulcan is a Vulcan is a Vulcan who couldn't see LaForge's body language. I mean, we discussed that. He kept turning on him and... Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, well, thank you for that. Hey, if you have any ideas, don't hesitate to come to me. Well, just so happens. Yes. But here's another thing. I think you guys are, you know, whoever said it, you're right. There are probably 50 engineers, and of those, 42 are supervisors. It goes straight to the chief engineer. I think somebody's nose is going to be a little bent along the way. There's a chain of command. And I'm surprised that
I've seen no evidence of Geordi's chain of command. So that's really the issue, yes. Right? There's no suggestion that there's any chain of command in Geordi's world.
I mean, why isn't Geordi sitting in his office, you know, reading crew evaluations instead of making them? He should have, you know, underlings under him, and those underlings are going to have underlings under them, who are going to have underlings under them. So you're right, there should be...
I think the only show that actually shows that a chain of command in engineering is Voyager. Because Scotty just has people who work with him.
Yes.
But he doesn't seem to have a deputy. You never see a deputy in under Chief O'Brien.
No.
And you never see a deputy.
Hang on, you do. Oh, though, yes. Right? Don't you have that woman that hangs around that ends up trying to assassinate someone at the end of the first season, right?
Yeah, but that was just... But after that, you never see anything.
No, but I remember...
Chief O'Brien.
And Dog. I know that that's not quite the same thing. But I do remember seeing that, by the way, and I was always very happy that, they're actually showing that it takes more than like one person wandering around the station to solve this. And they basically had her in for like three episodes, and then okay, did they kill her off or did they just arrest her? I can't remember how that
they arrested her. But still, there should be, you know, Geordi should be the overall manager, and then there should be shift supervisors.
But there is a chain of command, because when the Bolians, when he comes on the exchange thing, and Worf points out to him that if he has a suggestion, he brings it to Worf, because that's the chain of command.
Right. But even at that, Worf should have supervisors.
But in engineering, it's just...
It's always Geordi. Well, I mean, they have to pay another actor. The Geordi's lines get cut because, again, he'd be sitting in his office while his supervisors are running shifts.
Well, if you go back to season one, Geordi wasn't chief engineer. He was Khan.
Yeah, that's correct.
So, you know.
Yeah, he was Wesley. He was taking those night classes that nobody knew about. You know, until the round of chief engineers got done, and Picard said, wait a second, you did what? Oh, you've been going, you've got what degree? Oh, I think we could use you in engineering. Well, okay, yeah, you got it. All right. Where was it? Oh, so do you think Sam was right? Riker sleeps in his uniform? How's that possible? He can't sleep in his uniform. How can he do that and shag a different fellow crewmate every single night?
Well, we know he can sleep in his uniform because he's answered the door in his jammers.
Yeah. James?
I was about to say, the longer we have this show on, the more you use like British language. Oh. And you think that I'm not noticing.
Oh, I know you're noticing.
By the way, I really like the fact that they called out some of this with Riker because I've mentioned before, I really like Riker, and I don't really think I still like Riker that much. But the fact is that that guy is so much like Riker that it's, in fact, it's almost unbelievable, right, that Riker wouldn't see it. Because it gets like brought up in a bit later, saying I'm nothing like him at all. I happen to like poker.
But he even sits down on the chair like Riker
does. He's an exact clone. But I do like the fact that, despite these two people being completely similar, they don't see it in each other. And, you know, one of them just assumes that, hey, that guy, he must sleep in his uniform. But also, Riker is so horrendous in this episode, right? Aye, aye, sir. What? There's one eye.
Yeah.
Instant. I mean, what's that about?
One eye would be sufficient, of course. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, sir. I'll keep that in mind. Okay. Let's see. So, Actually, while you were talking, I wanted to see where most of our downloads are coming. I was thinking they come from the United Kingdom, and I guess I was wrong. Most come from the United States. Where was I?
It's a bigger country.
I guess so.
With more Star Trek fans.
Well, we can't get any guests, except for Chris, to come on from the United States. It's either the UK, Scotland, Canada, but... So what do you think about Sam trying to... So he talks about him. He shows a little disdain for him. You know, he sleeps in his uniform. Oh, please. I couldn't have anything in common with him. To walk over and kiss up to him. That was pretty damn funny. So, you're my third cousin on my uncle's dog's side is from Canada. Oh, really? Okay. Well, I'm from Alaska, so... Yeah.
Okay, so...
yeah.
Are people going to really be that petty? So first of all, I don't quite get this idea that in you know, 400 years' time, you know, after the Eugenic Wars and World War III, is there really going to be a divide between Canada and Alaska? I mean, is that still going to be there? Is it still going to be the case that someone that is, you know, like 20 generations removed is going to have... He's going to pull someone up on the fact that they're technically Alaskan rather than Canadian.
Yeah, it does kind of, also kind of against, goes against the grain about the future being an enlightened human race. You know, where money doesn't matter and so on and so forth. But apparently if you're born in the wrong province, that makes a difference.
Yeah, I mean, Reich wasn't very far away from saying, we hate Canadians where I come from. I mean, it wasn't... you know, the way he kind of gets shut him down. And also, right, you know, to imagine that... At least he gives the impression, right, that... What, are you asking me whether I'm a grandfather? I mean, really? Really? Is that the first thing you go to when you say, hey, aren't you one too? It's like, what? What, a grandfather? I mean, again, he's been a pain in the backside for no reason.
Well, he's playing with him.
Is he, or is he just being rude?
No, I think he's playing with him.
The thing is that because of later on the interaction between Riker and Troy, where Riker is basically saying with a straight face, you know, I don't think this guy is up to it, he's always a bit too, you know, he's a bit too eager and stuff. To me, it feels like Riker's not even, he's not playing with him because he's actually annoyed with him. It seems like this is actual proper annoyance rather than just kind of like, you know, a playful act. Because he knows that he can, you know, wind the guy up.
No, I didn't. If you mean like what Geordi was showing, I didn't see that at all. I saw the smiles and smirks on his face.
Well, I thought it was closer to like, you know, eye rolling.
No, but, that too. But he was. You know. I think he was getting some kind of fun out of it. He had him on the. In other words, he had him on the ropes, and he was just playing with him.
You've also got to remember, James, that Riker knows what's going on.
Yeah.
Because he's second in command, so he knows what's going on with Lot in relation to the Cardassians and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got other things going on in his mind than someone trying to suck up to him.
Yeah,
especially because he's not, you know, in this case, the ensign isn't female, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that if it was a female ensign, I think that Riker would give a lot more time to this conversation.
Well, of course, he would have embraced some romantic relations with her, since I'm not supposed to use shag no more. Intimate relations. Okay, come on, I'm part Austin Powers in a way. I know you guys hate him, don't you? Be honest.
I honestly don't have an opinion.
I haven't got a problem with Austin Powers. It is what it is.
He's a bad representation of English life, but he is what he is. Okay. Let's see. So, Riker sleeps in his uniform. Who should have been the one that was directing phaser shots to the shuttle? Should it really have been Geordi and not Worf?
Yeah, because Geordi would know what the results of the structural damage were.
Oh. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Put a shot right here. 4 seconds long. Well, should I do it from over there? Huh? Oh, yeah, good idea. Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, I don't know. What an amazing coincidence. Yes, yes, thank you, Anson.
No, I like
also,
this because...
the second time we see a phaser rifle in TNG.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, that sounds like... time we see it. Yeah. In TNG, in the series, it's only the second time we see a phaser rifle.
Huh. It's a phaser... Go ahead.
Okay, interesting. No, I'm trying to think about where would be the first. But actually, I like this scene. This is a nice scene. It shows you how much of a nasty person LaForge is. And the fact that his underling is, you know, he's ahead of him, right? He knows exactly what's going on here. And... The way that Geordi kind of reacts is, it's you don't necessarily want to see, 'cause you usually see Geordi being good and being, you know, being part of the team, right? Because you don't see his engineering team, you see the senior officer team, and in that he kind of, you know, everyone's pulling in the same direction. Whereas here, there's obviously something that he's trying to keep secret from his underlings, and I like that about this episode, by the way. That the fact is that there is stuff that these people don't know, and they have to follow orders, and they have to do stuff with limited information. And there's like the scene right towards the end, which I think is really interesting, which is everyone around the table has a certain snippet of information, but they don't share it with each other. But they each have their own part that makes them worried about. About the incident, you know, Sito having been missing for a while, and I think that's actually like, you know, that's a nice display that you usually don't see. Usually everyone's on the same page. Yeah, and actually I think it's also Lavelle, right? Lavelle doesn't, you know, he's despite everything, he's like oblivious to it all.
But it also makes sense that what they're doing, their individual pieces of the cake. Are with the senior officers because of the level of secrecy involved.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. And yeah, you have a little bit of information coming from, the security officer knows that something must be going on, and you know people aren't allowed in and aren't allowed out. You know that the medical officer has potentially seen the body. You know that the security, the engineer has damaged the shuttle in some way. That suggests something is being planned. So every single person having a small bit of information is, I think it's a very kind of like nice construct that they have in this episode.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and I do like the compare and contrast on the poker games as well. Two poker games going on at the
same
time.
Good.
Run with it. Run with it. Talk about it.
I can't actually remember who wins in this, right? Is it that
in the
wins
text
and the Bell loses?
I thought it was the
biggest Crusher. That doesn't Crusher.
No, in the junior officers, it's Ben, because he goes into the senior officers' room and says, "I've just cleaned these out. Can I join your gang?"
But I think what they have is that they have in both cases it's Riker and Lavelle that are the people that are. Hold in the hand, or at least believed to hold the hand, and it turns out that I think in Riker's case he wins, and in Lavelle's case he loses. And I don't remember whether Riker actually had a hand or whether he ended up bluffing or not. But it kind of makes me feel sorry for the junior guys, just because despite this guy being a Riker character, he's not. You know, he's not achieving. He's not actually nailing it. He falls short.
Yeah, but the other interesting flip side is, and all is in the senior officer's poker game, Troy points out to Riker that Lavelle reminds her of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he claims to be kind of, you know, not to see it, but I find that kind of incredible, as in lacking credibility. You know, He clearly must see it.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, Sam tries to bluff him, The problem is, when he looked at his hole card, it was obvious on his face that for a split second, it was a shit. Wait, I need to bluff. Oh, sorry, your first expression said it all. Yeah, I knew he was bluffing all the way. I would have called as well. Wrecker, on the other hand, doesn't he always win? Except for when Data's there.
No, I think Crush has won a few times, haven't you?
He is bluffing.
It's Worf who normally loses, because he can't bluff.
Yeah, he can't bluff. No. Well, the only reason Crusher knew is because every time they played the same game over and over again, she had a little bit of more information as to what was going on. And so did they, in a sense. You know, check, 4, deuce, 6. And I even think that was the sequence. I don't remember. But I think it was check, 4, deuce, 6. So Worf wants Sito to perform the Geek Tao. You know, the one where you get blindfolded and he beats the crap out of her. You must anticipate my attack! He could be anywhere in space, and she's supposed to anticipate where he's coming. But obviously this was an exercise, not so much to beat her up, just to see how much she'll take. And he knocked her down, what, 3 times?
So I've never kind of worked out in my mind whether I think this thing is cute or whether I think this is stupid. And because on one hand, it's like, yeah, you shouldn't have an unfair test, and you should sometimes see past the test that it appears to be being done. And they did that right in the first season with the Starfleet entrance exam, right, where it's all about, you know, conquering your fears, and it's not a proper test. It's more of a, you know, it's a test within the test kind of thing. But at the same time, I kind of feel like Worf is really I don't know. I think it's a bit obvious. I think Worf isn't the best person to have kind of delivered this, because he's quite simple when it comes to this kind of stuff. And I thought it was a quite obvious message that was being put across to her.
Who else could have done this?
Which, frankly, but what I mean is that, you know, Worf could have just said, "Hey, you do realize that when there's an unfair test, you have to speak out." You know, he didn't have to go through this rigmarole.
Sure, he did. He wanted her to come to the conclusion that she needed to speak out. I bet you he would have gone as long as it took until she finally said, "Wait, enough of this. Good, it's about time." Because that's exactly what Picard did as well. And when it didn't work, you know, he's dressing her down. I don't know how you got on this ship, but if I had my choice, I would beam you into space. Dismissed! She should have spoke up then, but she didn't. So now we got to try Worf, kick the crap out of her, and see how long it takes for her to then speak up.
I mean, about that, I mean, it surely should have been pretty clear that that people don't turn up on the Enterprise without the captain approving it, right? You're not going to turn up on the Enterprise and actually the captain wants to, you know, completely hate you and wants you off the ship. Otherwise, that would have been, you know, that would have been done.
Right. Yeah. That doesn't make sense under normal circumstances. But then again, you know, how long has she been out of the Academy? 7 months? We don't know where. No, yeah. How many years is the Academy? So she, you know, she may not know the inner workings of how personnel is brought on.
The Academy is 3 years.
Yeah.
And she had to repeat a year, so technically she's done 4 years.
Okay, that's true. Yeah, their credits were canceled, so 4 years, and here we are in season 7, and so it might even be a little early for her to actually be out of the Academy. But yeah, I could see where she doesn't know what he knows. And out of 1,000 people, how many transfer every month, week? Does Picard know every one of them? Who left? Who came? Who's coming on? He may get the report of who's who in the zoo, but does he actually, like, memorize it and know who's who? Her? He'll know.
I mean, didn't they have the big thing when Ro was was brought aboard, where kind of immediately, you know, Riker got the order and went, "You must be joking! There's no way this person's coming on board." So at least Riker or Picard must be aware of this, because, you know, previously they've objected at the, you know, at the second the individual was beamed across. Mm-hmm. And I know it was a slightly different situation, but you know, Picard was completely aware of Ro, and when Ro got dumped on him earlier on in the fifth season.
Yeah, that's going to be different, since, you know, what she did is, you know, worse, I guess. I don't know. But I also like the fact that we begin Deep Space Nine with Picard going through the same thing with Sisko. "Yes, we met in battle." Okay, you know, Lucutus killed his wife. So, yeah. Picard got a little bit of what he just put Sito through. I suppose it's going to happen. But somebody who just slides through the academy and ends up on a ship, I find it hard to believe that's going to catch the captain's attention, like he's even going to care. Alright. Wow. I don't know where we're... So now we finally get to the mission.
The actual plot of the episode, yes.
We get this Cardassian. He's a spy. I like the way they try to justify him being a spy. Yeah. If me trading against Cardassia will even stop one skirmish, then my work has been done. What nonsense. He turned his back on his people one way or another. How do you guys feel about his motives? And is he an honorable Cardassian just because he's helping us? Or does him turning against his own people mean something?
We don't actually, if you take it in the context of the episode broadcast, we don't actually know a lot about Cardassia as such at this point. I mean, we learn later it's basically a totalitarian government. And the military is, like, you know, extremely powerful. So he might be what we would class as a democracy activist. So if he's operating under the assumption that he's going to overthrow a totalitarian government, yeah, it's a noble cause.
I guess it depends on the point of view, though. It's like I've said before in past episodes, whose point of view is the right point of view? Ours, because ours is nice, or theirs, because theirs is mean or bad. Who's to say who's right?
Yeah, well, you've got the Romulan who said one man's butcher is another man's hero.
Well, I mean, this is always true, right? It's not, you know, it's not just about Trek, and also kind of goes through to the through to the real world. Whenever anyone is going to defect from your state, it's always going to be a traitor. Whenever they're going to defect from your enemy, that it's always going to be a noble cause, not a freedom fighter, or equivalent. So, I mean, you don't know what the situation is in Cardassia, but generally speaking, right, that they are a military setup, overstretched, and I suppose, right, if they can be pushed in a different direction, that seems to be enough for this guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very similar to what the the other guy did in the Defector, the Romulan. Again, just mentioning about overstretched military and like a leadership that is leadership that isn't taking care of the needs of the people.
Mm. Okay. And we also learn in later episodes that at some point the Federation of Cardassians had some sort of skirmish or war or something. So, you know, these are all like casting seeds to lead into DS9, basically.
Yeah, right. Okay. I guess because I've never been in that situation, I don't know. To me, it's really easy. Each person should be working for their side and their side only. But I guess I've never faced something like that.
What? You've never defected to a different government?
No.
Yeah, but you've got the CIA, Luke. They recruit foreigners to spy.
Yeah, I suppose so. But like I said, me personally, I've never had that situation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the best spies are people in their own country. So, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. So, but the mission, should she choose to accept it, is to take this Cardassian home. Make sure he gets back. And then try and get back alive. Did you guys actually think she had a shot in hell of coming back alive?
No.
Yeah. Oh, I did. I didn't.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't necessarily see this as I didn't see this as a suicide mission, despite it being, you know, being put forward by Worf that I had a few unkind words about earlier. But I kind of, you know, this is. So if they end the story, right, with this person being blown up or going missing, because I know there's a lot of like fan trek out fan stuff out there that suggests that maybe the person survived, maybe ended up somewhere else, etc., etc. But if they disappear forever, then you can tell another story on the back of that, and you can, you know, you can take that forward. But also if they return, right, it to me it doesn't feel like it. There's a It's still a perfectly valid story for this person to come back and to redeem themselves and to now, you know, carry on and do good stuff for the Federation. So to me, it didn't feel like
there was on what you just said, then James. They was going to bring the idea was to bring them back in Deep Space Nine.
Why?
Is that right?
Yeah. So it was going to one of the ideas they had was that she wasn't killed, but she was in a prison camp. And when the war kicked off, then she was going to be liberated.
That would have been interesting. And it was going to bring up. That would have been interesting, yeah. Then.
But the writer of this episode and the director of this episode said that it would diminish her death in this episode.
Well, yeah. I mean, she hasn't had her commission more than 7 months, and already she gets killed off. So she goes from killing a cadet, participating in a conspiracy to cover it up, to being a hero. So why would they bring her back? I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, I'm not saying that they should bring her back, but I'm saying that it's not necessarily... So this character is not irredeemable. Right. This isn't like Darth Vader at the end of Return of the Jedi, where you need to kill the guy in order to, like, you know, to complete his arc. I don't think that this person's arc required the character to be killed. So as a result, you know, I'm just mentioning that as I was watching the episode, I didn't necessarily believe it was a foregone conclusion that this person wasn't coming back.
Yeah, I don't know, because I feel like because of what she did and the conspiracy, the cover-up, all they had to do was keep their mouth shut, and they were good. But then, you know, they tell the truth in the end. She's got that hanging over her head for what could she possibly do to recover from that? To redeem herself? Show up for work on time each day.
The other thing and all. Yeah, but the other thing and all is we know that they've had people killed during the series. But this is the only episode where you see Picard do a shipwide announcement.
Yes.
So, you know, if, you know, to do anything beyond that would diminish that announcement. It would diminish her sacrifice and it would diminish her redemption.
Yeah. She had to die. It makes more sense. That's the only way she could be a hero. Or she can be redeemed. Yeah. She was cute, too.
But, hang on. Tom Paris didn't die, right? And neither did
Wesley. But his was a pure accident. And like he said the same thing. I could have kept my mouth shut and everything would have been good. But what was it, the Ghost of Christmas Past haunted me or something? Or
yeah, but you know, you probably wouldn't have been able to kill Wiggly anyway, because he's not entirely human.
No. But let's think about Tom Paris, though. What about the fact that, you know, he isn't even a Starfleet officer anymore? He's a convict, and the only reason he's able to redeem himself is that he outdoes himself for Starfleet on their way home.
Yeah, but I mean, even in Voyager, he gets busted back there.
Yeah, yeah. And spends 30 days in the brig.
Also, in the when they create the pocket universe for Harry Kim, Tom Paris in that pocket universe is a pool playing drunk. So
it was better for him to stay in the Delta Quadrant as long as he did, rather than get home quickly or whatever.
Yeah, because if they'd have just done the Badlands mission, he would have got a couple of years knocked off his sentence and gone back in prison.
Yeah. Right. So, him going along was better for him than him not going along. Nope.
And also, Sito's death gives you the final scene where, you know, Lavelle's got his rank pin. And he thinks he only got his rank pin because she was killed. So, you know, the death has many ramifications, and it's weird. This is why this is such a popular episode, because there's so many levels going on.
Yeah. Not the fact that you can get Worf, spend some time with the little people. So, all right. Well, I don't know. Would it have been too much for Riker to come say sit down? I know it would have been over the top for Picard to walk in and go, hello, Ensign. Do you mind if I join you? No, I don't think that would have worked.
Did you not think that the Worf thing was very un-Klingon, though?
As far as him coming to sit with them, or what?
Him moping over her death.
Yeah. She's in Stovacor, maybe. He should be proud. He should be happy for her.
Yeah.
But does he not need to process it by, kind of, you know, having a sing song or a, you know, or sit it down with some blood wine or whatever it is?
I think as soon as Picard...
They're not a prune juice.
Prune juice. Picard made that announcement. About 2 seconds later, you hear... from the bridge. I mean, you know it happened. What the hell was that? They heard it 5 decks away.
Yeah, so that's what I thought. I thought that this was really about... you know, look, so from a Riker and a Picard perspective, as soon as they've done their duty of just mentioning that the person was lost in the line of combat or line of duty, you know, I think that's kind of a, you know, that's where they get off, right? That's them done. They don't particularly, I don't think there's anything else that they feel, and it doesn't haunt them. Whereas I think with Worf, I just got the impression that this was something that was still on his mind, and he wasn't able to, he wasn't able to process it in the way that he would have wanted to. So that's why I think he then goes over to the, you know, to the other ensigns, and yeah, no doubt they end up on the holodeck a little bit later with a lot of blood drain.
Yeah. But I get your point. It doesn't make any sense that Worf would grieve over her. He always says it. Oh, I don't feel bad. I think it's... What was the episode where LaForge and Roe were cloaked?
And next phase.
Next phase. You know, he's like, oh no, I'm happy for Commander LaForge. He's gone off to the next whatever. So.
Yeah, but he wasn't banging LaForge, right?
Oh, you don't.
Well, of course he wasn't.
No, of course he wasn't banging LaForge, but you think he was banging Sito? I don't think so.
Well, I mean, it just seemed like a very, you know, clean way of cleaning all of this up, right?
I don't know. She didn't have any bite marks on her neck. She was walking straight, you know, not funny. That's, you know, something something really hurt. No, I don't think so.
As indeed was Worf, so yes, maybe you're right.
Yeah. I don't know. Riker, maybe. You think Riker, she's Riker's type? Oh, she's female. She is Riker's type, so. And she was cute, as I mentioned earlier. She was a cute girl, so. Riker? Yeah. Hey, Ensign, before you go stop by my quarters later, I'll give you a proper send-off. Just in case you don't make it done back. I don't want to ruin my record. Okay. So the Cardassian and her take off in the shuttle. Worf was there. And I think he did say good luck to her, didn't he? But why didn't I hear a kapla?
Huh. She's Bajoran.
Yes, but still, he says kapla to everybody. Kapla.
Yeah, well, he probably speaking to her in standard because he knew she was going to die.
Yeah, no point wasting my time on you.
Yeah.
No, I knew she was dead.
I mean, he could have just said, see you in Stover Court, it would have been easier.
Yeah. And that's an interesting point there, too. I mean, would really... So, Worf believes in Stover Court, obviously. Humans probably don't. Wouldn't it be weird if humans ended up in Stover Court with the Klingons?
So, are you talking about hell here? As in,
no, Greffel is hell.
No, Stover Court would be hell. They love hell. They would love hell. I think Grethor would be heaven. Oh, crap, I hate it here. I hate it here. No one to fight. Nothing to do.
Stover Court is where the honored dead go. Grethor was when the dishonored dead go.
Right, that's correct. But still, in Klingon culture, fighting is everything.
I'm just saying that from a human perspective, it's not exactly heaven, right? It's not part of the agreement we've been told to expect to end up with a bunch of Klingons.
I wouldn't want it, personally.
No, it's not Dante's Inferno for sure. No,
I certainly wouldn't want that. But what I'm saying though is you gotta think Klingons love torture. They love fighting. Jesus, they sit in rooms and headbutt each other all day long. So yes. What we consider hell, maybe Stover Court to them, because it's where the honored Klingons get to go and test their battle. Whereas heaven is so peaceful and calm that Klingons would absolutely hate it there. That could be their Grethor. I believe that. I'll ask Brian Dedimore on that when I get a chance. Alright. All right. So, what do we think here? Did I miss? Did we miss much?
Yeah, plenty. But I think, it's as good as we can get.
Oh, we could probably always do better. So the probe is a treaty violation.
Oh, that's irrelevant, isn't it?
Yeah, we're gonna do it anyway. Who cares? You know, space has speed limits, but. You could violate them when necessary. Okay. I don't know if I have any more. I really don't. So, James, if you got some more, run it out quick.
No. I don't. Oh. I don't. I mean, I'm happy to.
Okay, then. Good.
I kind of still feel that the only person that comes out of this without a huge scarring is Nurse Ogawa. Yeah. Due to the fact that she actually has she has a proper manager rather than everyone else seems to be somewhat shell-shocked. I think that we're done at the moment.
Well, let's not forget also she started this episode with boy problems. Doctor, I don't think he loves me. He had to cancel the date. That's terrible. No, he's got to do a lot more than cancel the date. Give it a break. Guess what, Doctor? We're getting married. And wait a minute. Didn't Crusher say she saw the man with another woman in 10 Forward or something?
Yeah, trying on a dress? No doubt.
Thank you. All right. You're starting to act like me now. That's a bad sign.
I mean, so, can you imagine either Geordi or any of the other guys? Can you imagine them... kind of, you know, being interested in the life of these people and asking them about their, you know, their significant other?
No. Not at all. Yes, I think Crusher is obviously the best person for the water cooler and the gossip and happiness and everything else. Troy, maybe? No, because she has to stay on a professional level, too. But you're right, the senior staff, made up of all men, no. No, they're not going to give a crap one way or another about what the little people do. Jeez, did I just call Star Trek sexist?
Huh. It's not sexist, it's just that a lot of the main characters have no empathy, which is fine.
Right. Alright, well, I mean, now that I think about it, Crusher and Troy are the only females in a command structure of any kind there, so that's another discussion for another day. Then I guess we are down to our final thoughts and ratings on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. And I know for a fact that Colin wants to go to bed soon, so Colin, you start.
Okay. I really like this episode. There's a lot of skill in writing of this episode because they have to do so many layers on so many characters. And you get hooked on the lower deck people really, really quickly, which is just a testament to the actors and the writing. I love the fact that we see the other side of the coin, and we also see the consistency in the fact that Geordi is basically a major douchebag to absolutely everybody. But we also get to see elements of the individual departments that we don't normally see. You know, we see Worf's unorthodox management style. We see Beverly basically being the best manager on the ship, like James has said. We just get to see the resemblance between those that want to be in the upper echelons and that are in the lower echelons. And there's a bit of humour in there. You know, Troy basically pulls Riker up on not liking Lavelle when he basically was Lavelle when he was on the Potemkin. You know, so there's that element to it as well. And we get little snippets of the Cardassians and a bit more about the Bajorans. And it's a good redemption arc. It's a really, really strong episode. And I can understand why they spun this off into the cartoon series. Because it's a firm fan favourite. So yeah, I'd give it a 5.
Okay, 5 out of 5. Me, it's going to be very simple. You said a lot of what I was going to say. I like the fact that we get to see the two groups at the same time in different areas of the ship talking about the other group and trying to figure the other group out. And so you called it the other side of the coin. That I like it. And you're right. The redemption is big. She is a hero now. She did what she needed to do. And I agree with Colin, what you said, when they thought about bringing her back, it would actually cheapen her loss, or her, I want to say contribution or something, or I can't think of the word I'm looking for, what she did for the Federation. So, yeah, I agree. This is a very, very good episode, and I'm with you on that 5 bus as well. We'll be writing bus number 5 and see if James wants to get on or if he's going to wait for the next bus number 4. James?
Hey.
Hey.
What's up?
Oh, not much. How have you been?
Good. Look, so I love this episode. I think this episode's great. We didn't have our initial thoughts on this, which, true. You know, I was kind of almost going to... you know, going to immediately announce that this is what, you know, this is one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek. I really think that it's great. I think that you know, I'm not too sure how often you can kind of do this thing, but certainly, you know, a one-off episode where you will have this kind of view of the crew. I think it's super interesting, and I think it's great that it's great that they had the opportunity to do this in TNG. You know, you're not going to be able to do this in TNG in the first season or anything like that. But as the series matures, I think this is exactly the kind of, you know, the kind of stories that you should be attempting to tell. You know, as the series matures, it's not just about, you know, finding long lost relatives of every single member of the crew, right? Which is what season 7 can sometimes be accused of. But I think that this is, you know, this is really, really good, and I like it. I'm not as big a fan as the follow-up they tried to do on Voyager. I think that the stuff they do on Voyager is, it just didn't feel as good and as, I suppose I'm going to use the word as original, but you know, clearly it's not going to be as original if they attempt to do something similar, you know, later down the line. So yeah, I'm always a 5 out of 5 on this episode. I think it's great. I think it's one of my favorite. I think this is one of the highlights of the final series. And actually, I think as Colin mentioned, look, you know, we've never seen these characters before. Yet after a little bit, we kind of do, you know, we kind of do feel for them. And this entire episode is carried by these people that we don't know. It's not as if there's a B plot or a C plot that kind of, you know, that attempts to carry some of the show. This is entirely on that, you know, that quartet of extensively new characters that have been introduced for this episode, and I think it's great.
Okay. All right, 5 out of 5 it is. So here we are at 15 episodes. I'm averaging 3.05 stars for this out of 5. James, you're very close at 3.7, but again, the 8 guests that have appeared on our show, the 8 times guests have appeared on that show, they're at 3.81, so it just proves the guests like Star Trek more than we do, and they should probably be doing this podcast, not us. But here's what's worse. In the next few episodes that are coming up, I don't see my rating getting any better. I don't know about you, James. I'm not sure.
Look, I'll let you know. I think the next episode's awesome. I really like the next episode. What's, you know, Thine Own Self is one of my favorite episodes of the season. It has Data in it.
Where Data suffers from, like, nightmares or dreams or something? I don't remember.
No. This is where he goes down and he's Mr. Radioactive. And he learns, this is, you know, this is an awesome, and it's also the episode where Troi becomes a commander.
Oh yeah, because yeah, and she wants to do what Beverly does now.
Yeah, and everyone knows that the thing you need to do in order to become a commander is order Geordi to his death, and that's straight away promotion to commander.
Yeah,
it's a good episode.
It's always a good thing telling Geordi's got to die. It's always a good thing.
Yeah, the way to get ahead in life.
Yeah, and also he neatly ties into this one, because in this one she promotes herself to commander.
That's an interesting question. Just because she takes a commander's test, can they just promote her to commander? Or there's no, even if there's no need for the position? Ah, stop it.
Well, she's head of the counseling department, so basically she's, you know.
Okay. All right, then. Let's see here. What have we got coming up for Colin next? Looks like I've got you and 2 more for Masks. The next two. Not the next two, but the second one from now. Masks. So I guess we'll see you then. Then.
Okay. I'll look forward to it. Thanks for having me back on.
Oh, absolutely. So everybody join us next time as we review episode number 16. Like you said, it's Thine Own Self. Thine Own Self. Sounded like Thine Own Self. Everyone, take care and good night.
Good night. Okay, I'm going to press the button, stop the record, and it's nearly 10 o'clock. We do go off on some. Click.